Welcome to the latest episode of Spanish History 101, and today we look at what is probably the most researched, studied, analyzed, and debated periods in all of Spanish history, the Spanish Civil War. As far as I know, no other period in Spanish history has been so thoroughly covered as this one, and you could easily devote an entire podcast channel to this subject. I guarantee that in the future, I will come back to it in more detail, but let's bear in mind that this is sort of a 101 summary of Spanish history, and I'll only set aside 2 episodes to discussing it. So, to those of you who are looking for more detail, I apologize, but hopefully many of you are still sort of in the dark about what happened during these 3 years, and I just want to start by getting a general idea. So, let's start with the basics. The Spanish Civil War started in July of 1936 and ended on April 1st, 1939. You had on one side the Republicans, who actually represented the legitimate government of Spain at the time, because it was a republic. And then you had the nationalists, who were the insurrectionists. The rebellion was directed by many high-ranking officials of the Spanish army, of whom Francisco Franco would emerge as the supreme commander under the rank of generalissimo. The nationalists under Franco would eventually win the war. This war pitted basically left-wing ideas and forces against right-wing forces. Both sides included heavily radical groups going from anarchist to fascist. It was a deeply ideological conflict, and yet at the same time a profoundly Spanish conflict whose roots went back generations. Other important factors were religion, monarchy, tradition, regionalism, nationalism, family feuds, neighbor disputes, etc., etc. They all sort of came together and collided for 3 very bloody years. Now, if you want to learn about what led up to this moment, I refer you back to our previous episodes, but to give you a quick background summary, the Second Spanish Republic had, since its founding in 1931, just 5 years before, suffered from constant instability. You almost get the sense that it never had a chance from the beginning. Political and social strife and turmoil and bitter discontent reigned at that time. Violence spread throughout the country, assassinations, murders of all types. The church was the victim of constant attacks. Churches and monasteries and convents were burnt down. We're talking thousands of them. And many members of the clergy were killed. So anyway, things were getting out of control. And as I've told you time and time and again, just as things seemed to be losing it in Spain, basically what would happen is that the military would step in and try to bring everything under control according to its vision of what Spain should be like. It's a pattern that had been repeated for over 100 years, and that's basically what happened here. You had just a massive attempt to overthrow the government. This time, it wasn't done by one individual or a small group hoping that the rest will join. This was a sophisticated, highly coordinated plan that involved the vast majority of Spain's most important military commanders acting more or less in unison. The uprising started officially on July 18th, 1936. In Morocco, which was a protectorate of Spain at the time. Franco, who had been banished to the Canary Islands to keep him away from meddling in political affairs, arrived there and was planning a way to cross over to Spain and push towards Madrid. In the meantime, simultaneous revolts took place in Barcelona, Madrid, Pamplona, Sevilla, along with other small cities and villages and towns all over the country. And there were varying degrees of success for the uprisers. The rebels, for example, in both Barcelona and Madrid were crushed, and those victories for the government gave many supporters of the government and Republicans the false impression that the coup d'etat would ultimately fail. But that thinking was premature. Now, the mastermind behind the plan was a general named Emilio Mola, who was stationed in Pamplona. But they did have another general who, in theory, probably would have risen to head of state. We are talking about General Sanjurjo. That's a tough one to pronounce. Sanjurjo. And he had already attempted to lead a coup d'etat several years before, but it failed, and he had been banished to Portugal. Shortly after the civil war began, he took a, or at least tried to take a flight from Portugal to Burgos, but the plane went down almost immediately after takeoff. And the reason most often cited was the excess weight due to the fact that the general wanted to take along with him all of his fanciest uniforms in expectation of becoming the next head of state. Those uniforms would paradoxically spell doom for him. So he was out of the picture. Anyway, Franco was slowly rising to the forefront as the sole leader of the movement. But before getting there, he had a major problem on his hands. How would he get his troops over from Morocco to Spain? Now, to make a very long story short, the Germans under Hitler provided the aircraft needed for the first military airlift. Franco relied heavily on the African Legion, many of whom were actually Moroccan of origin, because they were by far the most experienced soldiers in the war, at least at the beginning. They were battle-hardened troops that would make a very big difference in those first few months. Franco had also earned a strong reputation among his men during his stints there as an officer years before, and these factors would prove very important in the key first few months. Despite the immensity of the insurrection and its early success in some parts of Spain, the attempt to overthrow the government didn't fully materialize, and the result was a worst-case scenario, a full-fledged civil war. Spain was divided practically in two, equally, with the nationalist forces controlling much of Andalusia, the west of Spain, the northwest, and the middle sections, even around Zaragoza, and the Republican government holding on to major cities like Madrid, Barcelona, Valencia, Bilbao, and much of the Basque Country, as well as Asturias. At this time, the international community was cautious about just how much it was going to intervene in the conflict. Secretly, different governments supported different sides, but for the most part, countries were wary of getting involved out of fear of dragging Europe into yet another major war, like what would happen just 3 years later. And despite the fact that the nationalists, the army, had just committed an act defying the rule of law in Spain, many countries saw this as the only way of pushing back the encroaching presence of communism in Western Europe. In short, many were quietly in favor of Franco and his insurrection. The world's worker movements and much of the West's intellectual community were vehemently opposed to Franco and the fascists. They had seen Germany and Italy fall to that, and Spain was potentially the next. Writers, artists, journalists flocked to Spain to cover the story in some cases, and in other cases, actually take part in the fight. Just about anyone who was someone at the time was there. Ernest Hemingway, George Orwell, John Dos Passos, Langston Hughes, Robert Graves, Arthur Koestler, Virginia Woolf, Pablo Neruda, Martha Gellhorn, W.H. Auden, Cesar Vallejo, Antonio Machado, Ramón Sender, Antoine Saint-Exupéry, and many others. Some have called it sort of the last romantic war in the sense of how people from around the world joined it to defend what they consider to be a noble cause. But we know that other countries did get involved. Italy sent weapons, equipment, and even troops as volunteers, quote unquote, and Germany sent equipment, military advisors, and most importantly, German aircraft and its much feared Condor Legion. The Republican government sought and gained the support of the Soviet Union, at least in terms of material and military advising, but it came at a heavy price as much of Spain's gold reserve was sent there to pay for the support and never seen again. Russia's support for the war was insufficient. Anyway, the government also received backing from large groups of supporters abroad known as the International Brigades. These were often socialists and communists and anarchists from different countries who rushed over to Spain to defend the government. The military experience of these volunteers was often lacking, but they made up for it with their passion. The first months of the war were particularly intense in terms of violence on and especially off the battlefield. Widespread violence, killing, assassinating, raping, and torturing, often for personal reasons as much as political and ideological ones, resulted in the death of tens of thousands of people who were not involved in the fighting, just civilians. It was a shocking moment in that war. But anyway, getting back to the war itself or the fighting, the first main campaign was Franco's drive towards Madrid to take the capital. He pushed up sort of the western side of the country from Andalusia, and on the way, he took control of a city called Badajoz. And then he stopped in Salamanca, which is when he was declared generalissimo by his peers. This was important because there were several different armies at the time, led by several different leaders, different generals, but there wasn't one supreme commander. And that was when they finally decided to make Franco the supreme commander of the different armies. Then they freed a garrison holed up heroically in the Alcazar fortress in the city of Toledo, just south of Madrid, and finally turned their eyes on Madrid, which nervously awaited their assault and hoped for the best. The government itself didn't have very high hopes of success and even left for Valencia on the eve of the attack. For weeks, the nationalist troops attacked the western side of the city, but resistance was too strong, Franco's army was too small, and Franco too conservative to risk it. Had Franco prevailed, the war would probably have ended much quicker. So the front was locked and remained that way for the rest of the war. Franco tried two more times to encircle the city to cut it off and invade it from all sides. The first was in the Battle of Jarama in February of 1937, which again ended in a slight defeat for Franco. Then in Guadalajara, where the Italian forces joined Franco, muddy conditions hampered the motorized forces, and overconfidence by the Italians also was a big mistake. And once again, the Republicans repelled them. These victories were huge morale boosters for the government. So the offensive on the capital pretty much stalled. Franco then turned his attention to the north of Spain. Their operations under the command of Emilio Mola focused on Bilbao, the major industrial city of the Basque Country. It was also in April of 1937 that the tragic aerial bombing of the town of Guernica took place. The German Condor Legion executed the mission, and bombardments were carried out in at least five waves. It was on Monday, a market day. The carpet bombing resulted in the death of around 300 residents, which is the current accepted number, although there's still quite a lot of debate about that. The decision to bomb Guernica was an especially provocative one, as the town was the symbolic heart of the Basque Country. It was the former capital, and to this day, it's the place where the Lehendakari, the Basque Country's prime minister, so to speak, is sworn in at the old tree in the center of the town. Anyway, while that was not the first bombing of a civilian population, it was the first to get international attention and was very bad press for both the Germans and Franco, who didn't seem to care in the least and pressed on with their offensive. Anyway, this was the bombardment that was the inspiration for the very famous Picasso painting known by the same name. If you're in Madrid, you can see it at the Reina Sofia Museum. Anyway, in June of 1937, Mola was killed in a plane accident, yet another aerial accident, leaving Franco no rivals for supremacy, because even though he was the supreme commander, Mola also had a lot of supporters. Franco's troops pushed forward into Asturias and the Basque Country, and by October, most of the north was under nationalist control. Other battles in 1937 included Brunete, which was just west of Madrid. It took place in July when the Republicans tried to sort of break out of their encirclement and apply pressure on Franco. It was initially successful, but the plan failed in the end, and it was a costly defeat for the Republicans, who were really in no position to be losing men or equipment. And then moving east to Aragon, the two sides fought bitterly for control of a remote, basically useless, or at least strategically useless, town known as Belchite. The 2 week battle outside of Zaragoza ended up being a Republican victory, but a costly one. It would be recaptured in March of 1938. The old town where all the fighting took place was purposely abandoned and left untouched by order of Franco as a monument and reminder of the horrors of the war. It is still there for Civil War buffs to visit. And with that, we head into the winter of 1937, 1938. The nationalists under Franco are slowly strangling the Republican forces. The Northern Front has collapsed and is no longer an issue. Only the eastern part of Spain, Valencia, Catalonia, and some parts of Aragon are holding out and getting better about fighting. The militias that stayed loyal to the government but worked somewhat too independently have finally come together as a true army and are being more efficient. Will they have time to turn their fate around? Well, we'll find out in the next episode. So we'll stop there, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Spanish History 101. Please leave us any questions or comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Amazon, or Castos. You can also check us out on our YouTube channel and subscribe. If you wish to support Brian's Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, and Spanish culture. Our podcasts are free, so you can enjoy them, but we welcome listeners to support us if they would like to. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button on our website, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can do so by checking us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.